Duco, you're a storyteller, really, and you have a particular way of making a film, and your subject has been really children and the rights of the child and what is happening to children in today's world. In your film, The Living Rights, there's some very powerful stories there, and the first one, actually, that was shown that I saw was about a Japanese boy named Yoshi, who's got Asperger's syndrome, and his dream is to attend a regular Japanese school, and the film follows his struggle with that. What drew you to this story in particular?
The story is actually that this boy wants to be normal. He wants to be, and he is in between every world. He can't fit to the world of the mental handicapped. He can't relate to them in his school, but also in a normal school, which he's been before, he can't stay there because he also can't relate to these children there. So it's like a looking for becoming one of the group, one of the society, which is one of the rights of the child, even if you're mentally handicapped, that you have the right to be integrated into society. And for him, this is really a daily life struggle. So for him, life is also about becoming a student like everybody else. He was looking always to these other boys, and he wanted to belong to them. He wanted to study the same subjects.
I guess you spent quite a bit of time with Yoshi and his family. How was that?
Actually, it was very interesting because in Japan, though they photograph and video themselves, I think, in every circumstances or everywhere, the Japanese society about this is very closed. Also about having handicapped children, it's very much difficult to enter. Actually, I was happy that Yoshi came to me asking me if in Holland maybe there would be like a solution to his problem, and or otherwise a medicine or a medical operation which would solve his problem. And then more and more I felt that I could communicate with him in this way, talking about it, and also talking that even I sometimes feel like I'm an outcast, that maybe everybody feels like this, that everybody feels like that you have the other world and yourself, which is two different subjects. Then the next step was getting his mother, the permission from his mother, and we were really like, this was my only hope of making a film, if she would admit us to film with him. And she was very happy. She said that she thought that this would change his life. Actually, I think the film did partly, because some of the subjects he didn't talk before about with people, he started to talk, he opened up. So during the whole film, we became like friends, and also it was a process of talking, of like thinking about things, going to shopping mall, going bowling together. So for me, making a film is much more than just making a film. It's part of life.
I mean, I wonder how he responded to the camera being around so much.
He was very aware of how he looked like, even because sometimes if you use filters in camera, you can see your own reflection in the camera. And so sometimes before the shooting, he was just putting his hair right, just in looking inside of the camera. Actually, this aspect we also used in a style which I normally don't use in the film, but sometimes we asked him to communicate directly to camera. Anybody else would forget camera, but he nearly never did. And he was very much like, very much aware of his appearance. Of course, sometimes he forgot, but mainly he didn't.
I'm particularly interested in the contrasting stories. And you went out to Kenya, actually, to be with the Maasai tribe. And I think you spent, several months with them. There's a story of a girl called Toti there, an 11-year-old daughter of a family. And they want to marry her off. Aspects I found interesting in seeing the film was there was a sense of shame. There was female circumcision. The film kind of follows her journey, journey of liberation, if you like, into another kind of life that a lot of the Maasai tribe, I guess, do not experience.
Yes, it's a story about the girl. She's a twin, by the way, and her parents wanted to marry her off when she was 11 years old, and her mother warned her that she might be married off, and so she decided to run away, and instead of her place, her twin sister is married off. It's not common in Maasai life to go to school and to get education, university. People are needed, the children are needed for working with the milk and everything. It's like to survive this culture, this ancient culture, everybody needs to be working on their own life with the family. But there's a rumor which is spreading and spreading that there is a school and some lady running the school where you can hide and where you can go to school. So some girls run away, and it's happening more and more that they go to this school and try to get normal education.
Duco Telegan speaking about the Maasai life. Joseph Massendet of Friends of the Maasai, how important is education to your people? In particular, I'm thinking that some commentators have said that language is the most powerful modern-day requirement, and that knowing English and Swahili could be as formidable weapons as those of sharp spears in the battle for land rights.
Personally, I would say there's a lot to gain in education. And one way in which the Maasai can gain is to be able, for example, now that we are experiencing problems of our land being taken away, is to articulate some of the issues to the wider world and the wider communities as to how our land was taken away and why we need our land back. And one way in which we can convince the wider community is to be able to communicate in the language that the wider community can understand. And that can only come from education.
The Maasai people are a nomadic people by nature, and cattle herding's obviously very important to the lifeblood of the culture. How fast is the land used for herding disappearing?
Since 1904, we've lost three quarters of all the land. Between 1904 and 1911, there were two agreements made between the Maasai and the British colonial government. The Maasai were told their land was going to be taken away for a lease of 99 years. And between 1904 and 1911, we lost chunks of the best land we've ever had. The best land for our cattle, our livelihood, all went to interested colonialists who were interested in that land for farming. Then in 1911, we lost the Laikipia area, another beautiful highland area for Maasai cattle. We had been promised that will never be touched. We had been told there was an agreement behind it. That agreement was broken, and that land went away to colonialists again. As a result of that, we have lost a big part of our livelihood because a lot of our cattle depended on that land. And just to add on to that, after independence, the Kenya government decided to take over another big part of our land and transformed it into national parks. We have all those lodges, famous lodges, for example, it's Maasai Mara, and all that is within Maasai land. It's a protected area, and Maasais are not allowed to graze their cattle in the park. We get very little benefit out of this. We have been reduced to paupers. Yet we are a rich community with beautiful cattle who enjoy our way of life, nomadism. That's the way we live. We are people who believe in community land because anybody can graze their cattle the way they feel. We share the grasslands. And all that has been reduced to people who don't have a life.
And has there been a move from the rural livelihood to an urban, more urban existence?
We are bombarded. There's so much pressure. I mean, it's very difficult to survive as a community, and we fear that our culture is going to be destroyed when you have all these hungry, aggressive communities, self-interested capitalists who want to take over everything from us, who come in the name of development. So, I mean, we are seeing a big trend where now young people from the Maasai community, they seem to find the urban life attractive, you know. There's a big influence on the community towards urbanization. And I think this is happening to many communities. And I know a lot of people are disappointed that the Maasai have not transformed quickly because they would like to take advantage of our transformation from a cultural to an urban community to be able to take advantage of that and buy land from the Maasai community, and in that way extinguishing the very, very nature of our way of life.
How important are the old traditions of your culture in today's Maasai life?
I'll say our future can only be guided by our past. And I'll say our past has been full of guiding principles, respect, and I think that if the community wants to come out unscathed, you know, and be able to handle the future challenges well, I mean, it's got to be based on the past.
And in the Maasai tribes, is there still a great respect for tribal elders?
Oh, yes. It's not the politicians that run the Maasai system of leadership. It's the elders who run the community. They're the ones who decide. So there's a great respect in our elders. And politicians are just there, honestly. They have very little influence on the way the community governs itself and some of the things that happens within the community.
What do you think about the situation of the girl in the Living Rights film who wants to break with tradition?
The girl is very brave, because she's doing something that was unheard of a few years back. I mean, no girl would have run away from home and defy her parents or her father and run away to some urban school. I guess she has something she wants to prove. It's a new thing within the community. The community wants to embrace education. There's always been a slow move towards education because of the culture. We've believed all along in our culture, in our way of life. And education has never actually featured, you know, prominently, you know, in our day-to-day life. But it's now beginning to take a meaning. People are now beginning to see the value of education. This is because we have begun to lose, you know, some of the things that we valued, we were proud of. And some of these things include land. And this has awakened the Maasai towards the issue of education. And therefore, I think I will congratulate the girl in that film. I think she's done something very brave. And I hope she can come back one day after her school and show her father the real value of education.
Well, Joseph, thanks very much. Coming back to the story of Toti in Duco Telegan's film, I had another question for Duco. When the girl goes to the school and she has an education, she says that she wants to learn. Then maybe one day she'll be able to explain to her father why she ran away. That really stood out for me.
Actually, this is a sentence I loved myself so much, because also, if you would ask all the girls there why they want to study, all of them say, like, I want to help my family, I want to become a teacher, I want to become a doctor. But in the end, it doesn't tell you really why somebody wants to study. It's like stereotypes of life, which can be true, but it doesn't add poetry, it doesn't add some stronger belief inside. And I felt that this sentence explains everything, because education can teach you how you can explain something which you can't before explain in words if you don't know how to explain. So actually, I'm happy you found this sentence, because for me it's one of the main sentences how somebody could explain in beautiful words why you should learn.
And actually, the father ends up apologizing for what he's done, you know, understanding the daughter and even giving her a blessing, doesn't he?
He does, but at the same time, she's still scared of him. And also, you can feel in this scene, I think, that she has gone far from her own culture. It looks like two strangers with each other. It's not. He gives his blessing and she accepts, but at the same time, I'm sure that she feels scared. Actually, I know that she feels still scared that he will marry her off. And for her, even this traditional blessing of spitting in your hands and putting it on your forehead, it's like something which looks disgusting to her if you look at this image. But at the same time, I know also from her that she was very happy with it. So it's like a mixture of feelings, of contrasting emotions.
Emotions is something that's particularly running through all your stories, and particularly the one in Belarus, the story of Lena, a girl growing up really in the shadow of Chernobyl. There's a real sense of melancholy really running through the story of this.
Well, actually, I think this is running in the Russian soul in general, this melancholy, which I love very much. I think from all the countries I've been, it's most related to how I feel myself mostly. It should be there in the film. I think it's also so much connected to the way people living there in the zone of Chernobyl, most of them, they can't leave. Nobody has the money to leave the place and to go living somewhere else in a safer place. And after 17, 18 years now, most of them gave up thinking about radiation. A specialist told us that the radiation, if it becomes higher than 30, we should only stay there 10 minutes and then really run away. These people sometimes are in radiations of 50, 60, or till 100, and which is really unsafe. But they stop thinking about it. It's like also very much a Russian mentality, say, like, this is life, this is what we have, and this is all you get.
That struggle of life in the contaminated areas of Belarus, Linda Walker of the UK Chernobyl Children's Project, how have you witnessed this in the people there?
Well, many of the people living in the villages in the contaminated parts of Belarus realise that the food they're growing, the food they must give to their children every day, is contaminated. But families are poor, they have to live on the food they grow, and mothers are worried every day, really, about the future of their children and how it's going to affect them.
Now, Duco's described a sense, actually, of melancholy. How do the people cope with the environment there?
I think people cope in different ways. Some people decide to put it out of their minds, not to worry about it. Some people cope by getting together in support organisations to help other families who've got children with disabilities or children who are ill. But many people do find it very depressing. There's a lot of anxiety. Some of the reports which have come out about Chernobyl and its effects say that the main health problem is the anxiety amongst the population. But it's quite reasonable for people to be anxious about the future when they know that the air and the water around them and the food their children are eating is contaminated. It's totally unfair to say that it's just anxiety that's causing the health problems. The long-term effects of low-level radiation are bound to damage the health of children. And the biggest problem is that nobody quite knows how it's going to affect future generations.
Now, having passed the 20th anniversary of the disaster, what's the situation like for children all these years on?
Well, now, 20 years on, there are many young adults having children of their own, and many of the hospitals and the hospice and the associations report that there are a lot of babies and very small children with leukemia or cancer, or children born with congenital abnormalities. Lots of young children who have rare blood diseases that in Britain we would only see in elderly people. There's children with osteoporosis. Huge rise in diabetes in the contaminated areas. And there's a rise all over the world, but it seems to be higher in the contaminated parts of Belarus. But one of the problems is there's very little research into this. Apart from the thyroid cancer, which has risen phenomenally and is accepted throughout the world as being a result of Chernobyl, there's been very little serious research to look at which particular health effects and problems are linked to the radiation and which aren't. And until that research happens, no one will ever really be able to say just what the results of Chernobyl are.
I suppose it's hard to comprehend that many of the physical and mental disabilities that you've come across were actually caused by the nuclear accident.
It's very likely that many of them were, but nobody quite knows. There are many children living in the contaminated areas who don't grow. When you go to the orphanages for disabled children, there are lots of little kids, and you think that they're toddlers, and then you find they're 13, 14 years old. And this is one problem that could well be linked to the radiation. There are lots of babies with very severe hydrocephalus. Again, could be a radiation problem, might not, and no one is really trying to find out. It's very likely that quite a few of these problems are linked to Chernobyl, and I think it's really urgent for some serious research to be put in to find out the causes. Certainly when mothers are pregnant now in Belarus, people are monitored, and if it seems that there's likely to be a problem with the fetus, then most women would have an abortion. So they ought to be cutting down on the number of disabilities because there's much more monitoring than there was in the past. But they're not. The number of children with disabilities is growing, particularly in the contaminated parts of the country.
What's the attitude like to disability in Belarus?
Well, when we first started working there 11 years ago, it was really very much like the Victorian attitude in Britain. Parents were advised when they had a disabled child to put the child into an abandoned baby's home, send it to an institution, and forget about it. and where mothers kept the child, in many cases the father would leave because it was a matter of shame to have a disabled child. But it has changed quite a lot in the last few years. Certainly it's changed from above. The social services departments and the education department are trying now to educate children with disabilities and to provide better care for children with all kinds of special needs. There's still some way to go in the hospitals, I think. I think still some of the doctors will advise mothers that they shouldn't keep the child. But many parents are banding together to form associations and support each other, and things are changing. A lot of our work is with children with disabilities. We send specialists out to do training programs. We bring lots of people across to Britain. We've brought doctors and nurses and psychologists and teachers. And we've also brought people from the departments for social services and education within Gomel region and people in the ministries. And this exchange of information has helped change attitudes.
There's quite a lot of children's homes there, aren't there? You've been very involved with that.
Yes, and a few years ago, the Ministry of Education decided that they had got far too many children in the orphanages and they really ought to be trying to get them out into families. So we've had quite a major training programme, particularly in Gomel region, to train the directors and the staff in the orphanages so that they give better care to the children in the orphanages, but more importantly, to help them to get children out, to prepare families to foster them and to support those families. And that's had quite a significant effect. We're just about to start a new training programme on leaving care so that children who've grown up in orphanages are better prepared to cope with life, not just to go to college and hopefully to get a job, but to learn how to make and keep relationships, how to look after their money, just how to cope with the world around them, which is so difficult for kids who've grown up in an orphanage.
Can you perhaps give me a couple of the positive examples of how you've been able to make a difference over the years?
Well, we first began to worry about some of the young people who'd grown up in a big orphanage for children with disabilities. So we set up a small home for young adults. Three of them had grown up in a big orphanage and had no education at all, although they were perfectly intelligent young people. And the other one came from a boarding school where she'd had some education. And they lived together in this small family home. They've learnt to read, they've learnt to look after themselves, they cook for themselves, and they become part of the local community. And then we began to think about some of the younger children who had a lot of potential and weren't able to develop it. So we took five little children who had cerebral palsy, one child is blind, one has autism, and we've put them in a small house which we bought in the little town of Rogachev. They've got a lovely foster father and a little team of carers who look after them. And they've developed fantastically since they came to live together in this little house. They regard each other as brothers and sisters, and they're very much loved throughout the local community. And we're hoping that other charities might follow our example and help to get other children out of orphanages for disabled children. And certainly the authorities now realise that this isn't the way to look after children, that they ought to be in families if possible and in smaller units if not. Our latest project was to set up a respite care centre to support some of the families who have managed to keep their very disabled children, and families who've had to look after those children day in, day out for years. So we worked with social services in Gomel. We were given a large part of a kindergarten and we made a comfortable environment where children with autism or severe learning difficulties or very severe physical problems can have a week's break, looked after by a group of wonderful carers, whilst the mothers can have a rest at home. One of the mothers from the Autistic Association spoke at the opening event for this centre, and she said that when her son was born 13 years earlier, she had two choices. She could put him into an institution and throw his life away, or she could keep him at home and throw her life away. And she'd kept him at home, and they'd done everything together and been very isolated for many years. And then when a questionnaire came round to say, would you use a centre like the Mayflower? She'd said, well, I'd probably use it for a couple of hours. And then the questionnaire said, would you let your child stay overnight? And she'd said, never, that would be completely impossible. And she brought Dennis along to the centre. Then he came for tea. And then after a few visits, she left him overnight. And she sat by the phone till midnight, and the phone never rang. And the next time he stayed, she had her hair done. The next time she had a massage. And she said, now I have a life. And every morning Dennis says, when am I going to Mayflower again?
Well, Linda Walker, thanks very much. And the final few questions I reserve for filmmaker Duco Telligan. And Lena, she has a tumour, doesn't she? She has a chance to go to Italy.
Yes, well, finally, actually, it's already now for 4 years or 5 years. It was not clear if it was a tumour. Recently, they found out that it's probably an infection or something. But still, they're not sure. So anyway, for her, it would have been much better to go to Italy to be adopted, which is offered to her. But she, at the end, she decides not to go.
So a really awful dilemma running through that.
Yes, and the dilemma is even stronger because her mother, her real mother, is living in Minsk, where radiation is much lower. But she, the mother can't take care of her. She's very irresponsible. So she's staying with a far relative in this Chernobyl zone. So she found herself again like a family feeling, which she lacked for many years. And this woman, she can't have children of her own. So this woman really wants to keep Lena, but at the same time knows that Italy would be better for her. So it's not only the dilemma of Lena, it's also the dilemma of this whole family which she has there, that she don't want to lose Lena. So it's like a struggle. You can't decide what is best for her.
Christian Science Monitor commented at the time of your film Behind Closed Eyes, saying that you look at the real aftermath of conflict. You know, it strips away the politics, the military combat. You sort of really take the child's perspective.
At least I try. Because I'm, you know, what I think lacking in our modern media landscape is that we really feel people. Mostly our stereotypes of what we think, stereotypes of people, stereotypes of conflicts. And at least I would try, and I hope it would be also more often on television, that this world doesn't exist of numbers of people, but that everybody is a real person. So this is the basic also drive, I think, to make things like this, is that I want to see real people. And in the beginning we were afraid if you make a portrait of one person, you could say that this is like an individual, a unique situation, which you can't like expose to all the people, say like everybody is like this. But at the same time, this is also life. Everybody has his unique story. And so that's what we're always trying to find. So for me, it's just like, I want to meet people. I don't want to meet numbers. I want to meet people. And then I get excited. It's like when I make the film, I create like, I find a new friend. And I work with them together and we make something together. I always also want them to feel that it's their film. It's not my film, it's their film. It's their story. Which I think is something, a luxury as a filmmaker that you can, or as a person for me, to do this work. It's like, it's an honor. It's an honor to be with people, to be inside somebody's life and to understand something of it. Like in the Maasai community, to be there, sit and drink tea and hear some stories from them. It's better than going to a museum and just seeing about their culture but not really feeling it.